Thanks a lot for the invitation. As Daniel said, I would have loved to come and give a talk in person, but under the circumstances, this is fantastic as well. So today I wanted to tell you about some work that I've been doing with my Chicago area colleagues, as well as Gustavo from University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins. This talk is based on these three different papers. They are all doing slightly different things, but the general idea is to use cosmological data to test various beyond standard model scenarios, and conversely use particle physics experiments to put constraints on cosmological models, specifically with an eye towards a really significant cosmological tension, which of course is the long-standing disagreement between local or direct measurements of expansion rate H0 and early time inferences of the same quantity. So we will talk about the Hubble tension. They usually have these two measurements in mind. So one on the local side is the Cepheid-based distance ladder measurement from Riis et al., which comes in at around 74 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And this should be contrasted with the Planck measurement, or rather inference of H0, which is around 67 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Of course, the actual situation is much more complicated, but if you take this tension at face value, this is over a 4 sigma discrepancy. As I mentioned, the situation is actually much more interesting, mostly because due to the fact that there are many other measurements, both on the early time as well as the late time sides. So on the early time, for example, there is a completely different measurement that makes use of time delays in strongly lensed quasars to infer the local expansion rate. And this measurement has a completely different set of systematics, and yet it comes in also at a very high value, roughly with comparable error bars. On the early time side, you can forget about CMB completely and just use baryon acoustic oscillations together with measurements of light element abundances to infer a similarly low value of the cosmic of a Hubble expansion rate, which is compatible with the CMB inference. And just to make things even more complicated, there is a direct local measurement that's a distance ladder measurement based on a different kind of calibration of a distance ladder using a tip of a red giant branch stars, which is compatible both with early times and with late time measurements of Hubble. So for the purposes of this talk, I'll make a simplifying assumption that the true value of H0 is really closer to this measurement of Riis et al. So it's a little higher than what's extracted by the CMB and other early time probes. And we'll think about beyond standard model solutions that try to address this discrepancy. So I'm not going to go into the details of the precise physics that goes into these measurements. For these, I will refer you to some recent talks. One is by Raphael Flaugr that Gustavo recommended to me, and it's really nice. So this is a February 28th seminar at KTP, and another more recent talk from an experimentalist, Silvia Galli, from a CERN colloquium, as well as some review papers. So the point that I want to emphasize in this talk is that Hubble is actually not measured directly from the CMB, but rather inferred from the angular scale of CMB fluctuations in the sky. So this angular scale is usually called theta s. It's actually related to two different distance scales. One is the scale of a sound horizon. So this is the distance that sound waves have had to propagate in the early universe from some early time to the time of photon decoupling. So this is an integral of a sound speed, essentially, or a co-moving distance traveled from an early time out to the time of decoupling. You can express it in terms of the expansion rate at early time. So this depends on the conditions of the universe prior to recombination. So this is an early time quantity. So as you can see, you also, in order to determine this angle, you need to project this onto the surface of last scattering. So in order to do this projection, you need the distance, the angular diameter distance to the surface of last scattering, which is, in contrast, a late time quantity. So this is an integral of the expansion rate from the time of decoupling to the present time. So this is a late time quantity. And it's this thing that's actually proportional, inversely proportional to the local expansion rate. So the CMB experiments measure this angle, theta s, and you have a model to compute RS, the sound horizon. You can see we can very easily start to extract the local expansion rate by constructing this ratio. But the caveat is that you need a model for RS. Because of this tight connection between H0 and RS, it's actually interesting to look at the tension in terms of with sound horizon. So this is shown here. This is a plot from this paper by Ehler et al, which is casting the tension in terms of RS. So on the early time side, we have the Planck determination of the sound horizon, which is around 147 megaparsecs. And on the late time side, sorry, we have these two direct determinations that use these Cepheid calibrations of a distance ladder together with baryon acoustic oscillations, which give essentially a model-independent determination of a physical sound horizon scale, which is quite a bit lower. So the point is that even at this level of a sound horizon, you can see this cosmological tension emerge. And in order to make these measurements agree, you would need to reduce the Planck value by around 7%. So because RS is an early time quantity, you can kind of immediately intuitively see that in order to fix this discrepancy, one would need to modify physics before recombination. So this is a bit of a quick argument. There are some caveats that are addressed in great detail in these very nice papers by Ehler et al, Knox and Millea as well, Arense et al, which close these caveats. So the general conclusion of these papers is that in order to address the tension without running into problems with existing data, you most likely have to modify cosmology at early times, so before recombination. So what does this, anything of this have to do with particle physics? Well, as I've shown that the sound horizon actually depends on the expansion rate before recombination, so it's sensitive to the energy density that is present at those early times. So you have any BSM contributions, these can have an impact on the sound horizon and for the shape of a CMB. The other point that I'll try to emphasize throughout this talk is that the CMB shape depends on the evolution of perturbations in various fluids that are present during the early times. And the evolution of these perturbations in turn is determined in part by any kinds of interactions that you have between various components in these fluids. So these interactions can be both within the Stanimal sector or within any kind of dark sectors that you might think of adding in order to address the tension. So the simplest scenario that one can think of to try to reduce the sound horizon and therefore address the cosmological tension.
So sorry, Nikita, can I? Sorry to interrupt you, but you may shown this measurement. So Leonardo Senatore came out with a paper a few months ago with measurement of H naught from large scale structure that agrees with the CMB measurement. And it's at late times, right? Because it's large scale structure. Do you have it there?
So I'm not sure if I have the Leonardo measurement. I have this BAO plus BBN measurement.
Yeah.
So it's also technically, it doesn't, so I'm not actually familiar with the Leonardo measurement. I'm familiar with this measurement, which makes use of BAO. So baryon acoustic oscillations, the measurement itself also gives you an angular feature, which you must calibrate to some physical distance scale.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, the calibration comes from the fact that you can measure the baryon density and predict what the sound horizon essentially relate this angle to a physical distance scale. So the actual, the measured quantities of the angular size of the features of the baryon acoustic oscillations comes from late times, but you're calibrating it using an early time quantity. So RS. So in that sense, it's an early time measurement.
Okay.
But actually, I'm curious about this LSS measurement. So if anyone in the audience knows more about this, please let me know.
I don't know enough to hear
about it, right? So like what I recall is that he was using the entire shape of the two-point function, not just the BAO feature.
So this is what this measurement is. So I've abbreviated it as BAO, but this is this measurement by Flukox et al. So this has Matias Del Duriago on it as well.
Oh, I think it's the same group then.
Okay, yeah. So this is...
Well, it's a different group, I mean, but it's a very similar idea, I think.
Yeah, it's a very similar idea, same group of intellectually.
Yeah, so it's this measurement. And I've piled it into the early time category because you're essentially using early time physics to calibrate the H naught. Okay, so as I was saying, the simplest thing that one might imagine adding to the cosmology in order to somehow change the inference of H naught from the CMB is to add dark radiation, certain free-streaming relativistic species. And this model is often parameterized by ineffective. Ineffective is simply the contribution of extra degrees of freedom to the total radiation density, normalized in such a way that in the standard model, ineffective simply counts the number of neutrinos. So it's around 3 in the standard model. And with extra contributions, it's larger than 3. So why does this have a potential of addressing attention? As I've shown, RS is inversely proportional to the expansion rate at early times. So if you increase H at early times by increasing ineffective, you're reducing RS. And this in turn implies a larger Hubble constant extracted from the CMB. So you can use the latest Planck data in combination with baryon acoustic oscillation data to study the constraints on this scenario. And these constraints are shown by the dotted lines here. So the first thing to note is that the correlation goes in the right way. So the more radiation density you add, the larger the value of H naught you get. But you never quite reach the measurements of Ries et al., which is shown here by the gray bands. So why is that? There's a nice physical reason. In order to see or to guess what that might be, it's useful to look at the quality of the fit for this model in the best fit scenario. So best fit of an effective model compared to the best fit of standard cosmology, broken down in terms of the different kinds of data sets that go into performing this analysis. So I just want to highlight two rows of this table. One is a measurement, is an improvement in the local measurement in the local value of H naught. So negative chi-squared means a much bigger fit, much better fit. But this comes at a price of a worse fit to the high L tail of the CMB. So you can see a positive chi-squared here. And this is a nice physical interpretation in terms of photon diffusion damping. So in the early universe, photons are not perfectly coupled to baryons. The reason has to do with the fact that there's some mean free path that is determined by the scattering rate of photons off free electrons. And this mean free path means the photons have some time to diffuse. You can estimate the typical diffusion distance using standard diffusive arguments. So it's given by roughly by the distance traveled between each scatter times the number of scatters that a typical photon has undergone at a time t. So you can make this slightly more precise and compute the diffusion distance. So the square of this quantity is given by this integral, again, from some early time to the time of decoupling, and it depends on the Thompson scattering cross-section, the free electron density, as well as the expansion rate at early times, which is related to this t here. So, and this diffusion is really important in shaping the way the CMB power spectrum looks. So here I've shown a cartoon taken from this paper of the CMB power spectrum as a function of a multiple. So this damping is what gives this suppression at high L. So it's really one of the dominant features that one sees with the naked eye in the CMB power spectrum. So the issue is because you're adding extra radiation here, not only are you changing the sound horizon, you're also changing the diffusion scale. So precise measurements of this tail of the CMB preclude large modifications to the scale RD. So the name of the game becomes, how do you shrink the sound horizon without changing the size of the diffusion scale relative to RS? And I think this plot from Millay and Knox does a really nice illustration of, gives it a nice intuitive idea of what needs to happen. So this plot shows the fractional variation in one of these distance scales, so RS in blue, and the diffusion scale in orange, as a function of the redshift at which the shift in the expansion rate happens, or rather the sensitivity of the scale to changes in the expansion rate as a function of redshift. So the point is that these quantities, RS and RD, have different support in terms of redshift. So if you're modifying things out here, you're predominantly affecting RS, but not RD. If you're changing things here, you're mostly changing RD and not RS. So this means you can play with different time dependence in such a way as to maximize the change to RS without changing this ratio RD to RS. So all this to say is that if we're looking for early time solutions to the Hubble tension and the sound horizon tension, it's likely to have some non-trivial time dependence such that you change RS but don't change the diffusion scale compared to RS that much.
And the point is that just standard radiation changes Rd too much, but in the equation that you had, that seems to enter only in Hubble in the integral. So how isn't that just changing Hubble? And I thought the fit to Hubble gets improved, so I'm a bit...
So the fit to Hubble gets improved, but because you're combining different data sets, mm-hmm. you're making the fit to the CMB worse. And the reason you get a worse fit to the CMB is because in addition to changing RS, you're also changing RD. And it turns out that...
Right. Yeah. But you're changing RD just due to the changing Hubble, right?
Yes.
Okay. But somehow it's just different data.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, it's a balancing act, right? You're making one thing better, but you're making another thing worse.
Okay.
Okay. So here's a quick checklist for a BSM explanation that I'd like to make use of. So first, we need extra radiation density. Hopefully that's was clear from the previous discussion. And you also most likely need some non-trivial time evolution in this energy density. So this will be the subject of the first part of my talk. I'll actually deviate from the second condition in the last two thirds. And the thing that hopefully will also become clear is that these effects are only, of what I've described so far, are only background cosmology effects. The CMBs are also very sensitive to the evolution of perturbations, which will be very important. So if somebody asks a theorist, how do I get a time-dependent energy injection at early times without messing other things too much, probably the most common answer that you will get is that what if some fraction of dark matter decays at early times into dark radiation? So it's kind of one of the obvious scenarios that one can think of. So this is as an introduction, I'll consider this scenario first. So this, imagine there's a fraction of dark matter decays in dark radiation with a certain decay rate here. So this scenario has both of the ingredients that I've shown in the last slide. So it allows you to inject extra energy, and you can do it in a time-varying fashion. So this plot here shows schematically the fractional variations and the two quantities that emphasized are important. So this is a fractional variation in RS, and this is a fractional variation in this ratio of RS to the diffusion scale as a function of the lifetime of this decaying component. And the three different lines in this case correspond to the fraction of the decaying dark matter. So this is intuitively doing exactly what you expect. So the more decaying dark matter you have, the bigger energy injection is, so the bigger the reduction in the sound horizon is. And because of the time dependence of this energy injection, for a specific choice of a lifetime, all of these curves pinch together at zero, which basically means that you've placed the energy injection in such a place that the variations to both of these quantities are equal and they cancel. So naively, this model would do exactly what you would want. Of course, the actual situation is much more complicated precisely because of the evolution of perturbations. So the point I want to make here is that extra matter from decaying dark matter that's present in early universe actually changes the evolution of the gravitational potentials at early times, which leads to an imprint on the CMB, which prevents you from adding too much of this decaying component. So how does this work? So one factor you need to know about the early universe is that gravitational potentials decay during radiation domination. So it's very easy intuitively to understand why. If you start out with some overdensity at early times, because the dominant fluid that's making up this overdensity is radiation, the radiation pressure will push the overdensity out, and these are very corresponding gravitational potentials will decay away. And this decay is timed in such a way as to drive the Kusak oscillations in the plasma at that time. So it really amplifies the size of the perturbations. But if you add extra matter, such as coming from cold decaying dark matter, the gravitational potential decay is incomplete. So change the evolution of the gravitational potential essentially, and this changes this amplification. So here's a numerical example of this effect. So here I'm showing the observed photon fluctuation as a function of a scale factor for different models. So the dotted line is lambda CDM, and the green lines from lighter to darker are different decaying cold dark matter models. And the only thing I want to take away from this is that the more cold dark matter models you add, the larger the suppression to the photon perturbations is at the time of decoupling, which is around 10 to minus 3, which is precisely coming from the fact that you're changing the evolution of gravitational potentials at early times.
And Nikita, just to make sure I understand, like in this plot, you're saying you're keeping the redshift of matter radiation equality fixed, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's more, Gustavo always calls me out on complicated things. There is a bit more going on in this plot because if you were to not fix the redshift of matter radiation equality, things would look even more different, essentially because this really also determines how amplified the fluctuations are in early universe. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, and you do it by just adjusting the amount of the regular density of dark matter.
Exactly, yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And so the thing to do now is that you can take the cosmological data, Planck results together with baryon acoustic oscillations, and study whether this decaying dark matter model is consistent with that data. And the answer appears to be no. So there's a bound on the amount of decaying cold dark matter you can have that prevents you from addressing the Hubble tension fully. So this is work done by Vivian Poulenc and collaborators a few years ago. So these plots show up a serial distribution of the decaying dark matter fraction. So you can see that there's a bound on how much dark matter can decay with lifetime in this range. So it's less than around 10%. This is using old Planck data. Here's an updated result in the plane of H0 and decaying cold dark matter. So this is the latest Planck data release. And the constraints have gotten even more severe. So you can see that the posterior extends to smaller fractions, and it doesn't even reach the Riesz measurement. So with this introduction, I want to go on to one of the models that I've studied. And the intuition is the following. So I've argued that there are strong constraints on decaying cold dark matter that follow from its impact on the evolution of gravitational potentials. So an obvious modification to this scenario is to consider a decaying component that doesn't cluster the same as matter. And a really simple possibility, a simple example of this, is a particle with some kind of a significant velocity from a cosmological point of view. So this is a particle with, let's say, a thermal distribution that travels a significant distance before becoming fully non-relativistic. You can estimate what this distance is. So this is a free streaming scale, which is simply the integral of its velocity from some initial time to a time at which it becomes non-relativistic. It can very easily be estimated. For a thermal particle, it's around 30 microparsecs for masses of around 10 eV and temperatures comparable to the standard model temperature. So these scales are exactly the scales that are relevant for the sort of high L part of a cosmic microwave background power spectrum. So the point is that such a particle would not cluster on scales below this free streaming scale. It wouldn't have the same impact on gravitational potentials, and potentially, hopefully, would have a better job of explaining the H0 tension. So just to give an example of how to realize this in a particle physics model, it's really easy. All you need is a stereo neutrino, which I've called N here, that's coupled to some light mediator phi. So these models are very familiar, and they often occur in scenarios with spontaneous lepton number violation where phi can play the role of the pseudonumber Goldstone boson of lepton number breaking. But this Lagrangian already has all the ingredients to make such a model work. So in the early universe, you can produce these right-handed neutrinos through what's called the Donaldson-Woodrow production mechanism, which is essentially a Friesen-like mechanism where the animal neutrinos scatter, and some fraction of the time they produce a right-handed neutrino through this mixing, which is related to this coupling here and this mass here. And the decay is, of course, realized by this other interaction, where a heavier neutrino, heavier right-handed neutrino, can decay into lighter neutrinos, as well as the mediator, or rather the light scalar phi. So from a point of view of this production process, this gives a thermal-like distribution. So there's a distribution that's roughly Fermi-Dirac-like with the temperature given by the neutrino temperature. But because this process occurs out of equilibrium, the density of bright neutrinos compared to standard model neutrinos is less than thermal. So for specific choices of parameters, you get densities that are like order one, but still smaller than fully thermalized. So what makes this kind of scenario interesting and challenging to study is that different parts of the phase space of these particles decay at different times, simply because there are some parts of the phase space are more boosted than others, which means they will decay slightly later than others. So in order to study this, you need to solve the full momentum-dependent Boltzmann equation, which I've shown here. So the left-hand side is our usual Liouville terms. On the right-hand side, I've written down the collision term that encodes the decay. So you can see that this collision term determines, or rather depends on the mass and the energy of the particles. So you can see the suppression from energetic particles will decay later with essentially a longer lifetime. And these two panels show the solution to this equation for two different masses. So the left panel shows 1 electron volt mass, the right panel shows 10 electron volt mass. This is the distribution as a function of the momentum, normalized in some quantities, normalized to some temperature. But the point is here is that in this light case, you can see that the slower moving particles with a low momentum, they decay faster than the ones that are moving faster. In contrast, when the mass is larger, the distribution more or less gets rescaled by the same amount. So this is kind of like a cold decaying dark matter.
Sorry, Nikita, what are the different curves for?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's a good question. I should have mentioned this. The different curves are different times. So the darker lines are earlier times, lighter. So you should think of this as a time progression from early time to late time. So this is showing the various stages of a decay of a distribution.
Oh, as a function of time.
Yes. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that.
Okay. And the lifetime here is 10 to the 4. Where do you start it from? I guess, how much does time change in this plot?
That's a good question. I think it's of order, so the final time I'm showing is maybe a factor of 100 after the lifetime. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, to be honest. I mean, you can back this out by how much the distribution changes. Mm-hmm. So it's roughly log of 10 to the 18, I guess, or something like that.
Yeah. It must be comparable. Yeah.
So it's, I think it's a factor of 20 or something like that.
Okay.
And is there any intuitive way to understand why this is going to improve the fit to the perturbations? Because now if you suppress, in the previous plots, you were suppressing power in the CMB mm-hmm. for larger fractions. This seems that will lead to further suppression of power.
My intuition for starting this was precisely having to do with the effect on gravitational potentials. I think what you're alluding to is actually what's realized in data. And I think to make the long story short is that we'll find that you don't significantly improve the fits compared to an effective essentially. Essentially for the reason that you've described.
I see.
I was hoping it would work better, but it turns out that it doesn't quite work as well.
Okay, and another naive question. So, these right-hand neutrinos, by now they have decayed. So, I guess that you will show us also limits from X-rays or something like that. Or aren't there like strong limits from that?
No, I don't think so. So, for the mixing angles that I'm thinking about. So, first of all, I haven't computed those limits explicitly, but just from glancing at the literature briefly, these kinds of decay rates. Sorry, these kinds of couplings, these kinds of mixing angles are pretty compatible with all laboratory bounds?
I mean, there are these bounds like from the non-observation of X-rays just from the sky, right? These Athena bounds or...
Oh, no.
What? Sorry, what?
The masses are order electron volts, no?
Yes, he has 10 electron volts, I think, and just looking at a plot now. Yeah, oh, yeah, so that's true. Yeah, it's true. It's you are below the, your masses are much lighter.
Yeah, also, these lifetimes are very short, so by the late universe, these things are completely gone.
Right, by now these things are gone, right.
But that's not, like, these decay to photons, right? What do they decay to? Sorry.
So the dominant decay rate is into...
Fi, oh.
Yes, it's basically a neutrino going, a heavy neutrino going into dark radiation. That's what's actually implemented at the level of Boltzmann equations.
Yeah.
This is just an example scenario that can realize such a model.
Yeah, so I don't know, should you expect any photon signals from this?
I think you could in principle. So what one can do is one can close a W loop or something like that. So you can decay into...
Oh, like a dipole moment. But yeah, that's a exactly. Three-body decay, and that's suppressed in fractions.
It's incredibly small.
So but what about distortions at the CMB? I thought those were pretty sensitive because you decay before at around the time of matter radiation equality, right?
Yes, that's right. That's where this 10 to the 4 comes from. I want these decays to happen before recombination, but not too much before.
Yeah, so then if you have a significant fraction of decay to photons, I don't remember, you distort the CMB spectrum.
Yeah, you definitely would distort the CMB spectrum, but in this case, if the branch fraction is really tiny.
Yeah, it probably is. Like, if it's a W exchange.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the rate would be really absurdly small.
Yep.
But does small mean 10 to the minus 4 or something? Or does it mean 10 to the minus 40?
So at KV masses, these are branch ratios of 10 to the minus 10. So at EV masses, with this new scalar decay, I would imagine it's going to be very, very small.
Yeah, it's going to be like... Then it's six orders of magnitude less, probably, because like a mass. Oh, even more. Sorry. Yeah, no.
It's super small.
Yeah. Anyway. Let's continue.
Okay. Yeah, so I think probably those bounds are not, don't constrain this particular model. So the way you get actual quantities that you're interested in from a point of cosmological evolution from this distributions is by integrating them. So here, this plot is kind of showing the evolution of the energy density, number density in the decaying component, as well as the density in the radiation component as a function of a scale factor. So it's kind of the quantities that enter the Hubble expansion rate at early times. So the important thing to note here is that at early times, the decaying component, you can maybe eyeball it, but this goes like scale factor to the fourth. So this is radiation-like dilution. So this is before the warm dark matter becomes non-relativistic. Eventually, it transitions into non-relativistic behavior here. So you can tell because it's matching onto the evolution of a number density with the mass scaling. So these lines become close together, and eventually you decay away. So there's a small period during which you're doing something non-trivial at around this non-relativistic to relativistic transition. And part of the problem of this model is that this period is fairly confined, so you're only doing something weird during maybe an e-fold or so. So this is the first indication that this might not be that different of a scenario compared to decaying cold and ineffective models. So the other thing that I was hoping to emphasize is that the CMB is also sensitive to phase space perturbations. So we must also solve for those. So Daniel mentioned during lunch how much of a pain it's to implement these equations. So I sympathize to your pain. We've done this for this decaying warm dark matter scenario. So we've looked at the evolution of perturbations, which are often parameterized in terms of these fractional perturbations. These now depend both on the position as well as the momentum of the particles. And you can relate these perturbations in the phase space to perturbations in the quantities that actually source Einstein's equations, by integrating them. So here's an example for energy density perturbation, which is related to the first multiple moment of this distribution here and the background distribution. So we implemented the solutions. We implemented the equations, the relevant Boltzmann equations in the Boltzmann solver class. Here's an example of a couple of solutions for the energy density contrast as a function of time. So here I'm showing two different masses. So this is 1 eV and 10 eV again for two different models. One is the cold dark matter model, decaying cold dark matter with as a dashed line. And the solid lines show the decaying warm dark matter scenario. So the point I want to highlight is specifically the suppression in the density contrast, which is precisely due to this free streaming effect that we're after. So this model does seem to be doing what we're after, and it does have a reduced impact on the gravitational potentials because of a suppression in the density contrast. So the thing to do next is to see what the impact is on the actual CMB power spectrum. So these two panels show the fractional shift in the CMB power spectrum normalized to the standard model, or sort of lambda CDM cosmology. So for three different models, the black line again is the decaying warm dark matter scenario that we're studying. The dashed line is the decaying cold dark matter scenario, and an effective is shown by the dotted line. And the panels show 1 eV and 10 eV again with a fixed mass, or a fixed lifetime, sorry. And in all cases, I've chosen model parameters in such a way that they all give the same amount of total radiation at late times. So the important thing to note here is that if a mass is small, the particle is essentially semi-relativistic, and you can barely tell this apart from an effective model. So this is something that Daniel was alluding to. I wish he was my collaborator, so he would have told me to maybe not spend so much time on this model. But basically, you can barely tell this apart from ineffective. In contrast, when you go to a larger mass, this model starts to approach that of DCDM, so decaying cold dark matter scenario. And if you increase the mass even further, there's an even better agreement with that scenario. So this model really interpolates between decaying cold dark matter scenario and dark radiation, which is good intuition for why this won't provide kind of a mind-blowing solution to the Hubble tension. So with that in mind, we've still performed a full Monte Carlo study using the latest Planck data.
Akita?
Yes?
Could I just ask, what sets the mass scale in which you change over the interpolation between the two different regimes?
I think essentially the free streaming length. So the tail of a CMB corresponds to like tens of megaparsecs. So if the free streaming length is significantly smaller than that, then you won't have, it's some combination of the free streaming length combined with the decay rate.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
So we've performed a full Monte Carlo study of this model in the context of the latest Planck data release and Baryon acoustic oscillations. These two panels show the results specifically geared towards the Hubble tension. The three different colored blobs correspond to three different masses, so 1 electron volt, 10 electron volts, 40 electron volts. This one has a lifetime on the x-axis, the other one has the initial abundance. So this is not the ineffective at late times, this is ineffective while the particle that will decay is still relativistic. So this isn't a final amount of energy density. So you do see some positive correlations, and you do get sort of close to this measurement of reset all, but you're still in 2 or 3 sigma tension. So this model doesn't quite resolve, it doesn't resolve the tension completely. It can be reduced by maybe around 1.5 sigma, but at the price of a couple of extra parameters. And you can see that the data prefers either having really low masses, which means that the particles are essentially relativistic throughout the CMB or semi-relativistic, or short lifetimes, which means that they decay away very early on, and the model, in either case, acts like ineffective. So that's why these constraints are somewhat similar to constraints in effective, and effective similarly reduce the tension by a comparable amount.
Nikita, just to clarify one thing. So for you're showing those masses, but this is if you're assuming that the temperature is the same as the neutrinos. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So that's a good question. So there's another parameter there that's that could be varied. In principle, but
probably as long as you scale the ratios, it's probably the same, right? It probably only cares about m over t or something like that.
Yes, I mean, so there's also going to be some degeneracy with the lifetime. Because the temperature sets a typical momentum, which determines a boost. Yeah, but something I haven't explored.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure this is exactly the same, because it's true that the scales are m over t, but then in the distribution function, I don't know if it's m over t exactly. The rescaling is the same.
Yeah, I'm not sure though. Yeah, I mean, the problem is that the distribution evolves in some non-thermal way once the decays begin, so it's hard to make these like thermal-inspired scaling arguments.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it doesn't work that well. So I want to talk about another scenario. It's an interacting radiation. What time did I start and how much time do I have?
You started like 2:05. You still have 20 minutes.
Okay, sounds good. So this is the work that I've done with Gustavo. So let me go through a bit of an introduction again. So in the previous discussion, I've kind of emphasized that the extraction of Hubble rate from the CMB is really a measurement of the sound horizon. And you can't change the sound horizon that much because you're being constrained by the amplitude, the observed amplitude of CMB peaks, which is in turn related to the diffusion scale, which is also modified whenever you add extra degrees of freedom in the early universe. One thing that I've failed to mention so far is that peak position also depends not just on the background evolution, so not just on the scale of a sound horizon and the angular distance to the surface of less scattering, but it also depends on the evolution of perturbations in the early universe. So one can schematically write that the peak position, which is measured precisely in the experiments, is related to these quantities which are introduced, but it's also related to the evolution of perturbations which enter as a phase shift in the peak position. So there's a vast number of sources for this phase shift, many of which are outlined here, but I want to focus on one specific one. And this phase shift has to do with free streaming species. And it's very easy, intuitively at least, to understand why one would expect a phase shift in the CMB from free streaming species. And it has to do with the fact that they propagate supersonically, as some of these particles propagate with the speed of light, whereas the speed of sound in the plasma is around 1/√3. You can see this nicely, why this might be important in this in these two panels, which show snapshots at two different times of the perturbations in the primordial fluid of a particular scale. So this shows an early time perturbation for photons and baryons, as well as neutrinos, and at some later time where these perturbations have had to propagate under the influence of their own pressure and gravity. So the photon and baryon perturbations has propagated some finite distance. So this is precisely the sound horizon. This is how far it's had to propagate at that particular time. But the neutrinos, because in the Stanimal they're free streaming, they propagate with the speed of light. They can propagate this beyond the sound horizon. As you can see, that there is a large density of neutrinos beyond the sound horizon, which will affect, which will exert a gravitational pull and shift where the peak is precisely. So if you were to compare where the peak is with and without neutrinos, you would find a phase shift. And in these two seminal papers by Bashinsky and Seljak, as well as by Bauman et al. More recently, people, they've computed what this phase shift is, and it's related to the quantities that one naively would expect. So the amount of energy density in the species that can propagate supersonically, so the number of the amount of free streaming species, relative to the total amount of radiation at that time. So with this in mind, I want to consider an extended cosmology where you have both free streaming species as well as non-free streaming species. So at the background level, I've added an additional parameter called n fluid in addition to an effective. And at this level, it's these parameters are exactly degenerate, but their perturbations evolve very differently. So this kind of scenario actually has a nice history with PI because it's been studied by a former PI postdoc as well as Chris Sigurdsson from UBC around in 2017. So here, part of the work that Gustavo and I did was update the constraints in light of the most recent CMB bounds, as well as added some interpretations in terms of particle physics models, which hopefully I'll get a chance to talk about. So in addition to this parameterization, we can also parameterize the amount of radiation in terms of these variables. So m toad is a total amount of radiation, like degrees of freedom, and this fraction f is the fraction in free streaming species. So what is the impact of these non-free streaming degrees of freedom? So one is has to do with this phase shift. So as I've mentioned, the position of the peaks depends on the fraction of free streaming species relative to total radiation. So if you add extra non-free streaming radiation, you're essentially reducing the fraction of free streaming radiation, which undoes some of the phase shift that's present in the standard model. And this is important because the position of the peaks, remember, is also related to the sound horizon, which in turn is related to the Hubble tension. So this means these kinds of models have a non-trivial interaction with the Hubble tension. So that's interesting. The second less appreciated effect, I think, is that non-free streaming species actually tend to enhance power of small-scale photon perturbations. And this has to do with the fact that in relating the photon, the gravitational potentials at early times to the curvature perturbations that are set up by inflation, one needs to account for free streaming species, which tend to dilute the size of the gravitational potential. So if you reduce this ratio by adding extra non-free streaming species, you're essentially boosting the early time gravitational potentials. And because of the radiation driving effect, the amplitude of photon fluctuations is proportional to the gravitational potentials at these early times. So you essentially, by introducing non-free streaming species, you're boosting the amplitude of photon fluctuations. But remember that the amplitude of those photon fluctuations is also related to the diffusion scale, which is also something that's interesting from a point of view of constraining models that seek to address the Hubble tension. So just both of these...
And just to be clear, by non-free streaming, you mean you cut all the higher moments of the hierarchy. So it's just theta zero and theta one, and then it's not like the drag thingy. It's literally...
That's exactly right. So this is the scenario that Gustavo and I considered. If I have time, I'm going to talk about a related scenario where non-free streaming ends, which is, I think you've had a talk about, which is also interesting for a point of view of Hubble tension.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. So here's a simple model that one can keep in mind for implementing such a scenario from a cosmological point of view. Consider a pure non-abelian dark sector. This is just a bunch of gluons and whatever non-abelian gauge group that you want, such as SUN. These gluons have self-interactions like the cubic and the quartic vertices shown here. So naturally, if a confinement scale in this sector is low enough, the relevant degrees of freedom are gluons and they scatter. For a very modest requirement on the coupling constant alpha d in this case, the scattering rates can be substantial throughout the epoch of a CMB. So as long as alpha dark is 10 to minus 12 or larger, you're essentially in the fluid-like regime and you're precisely realizing this scenario that I've just described. And note that this coupling constant is so small that you're really far away from confinement. So the relevant degrees of freedom really are gluons and not anything else. These kinds of models have been studied by Gustavo and colleagues previously. So in this parameter space of n total and the free streaming fraction, this model realizes n total greater than 3 because you've added extra radiation. And the free streaming fraction is now less than 1 because you've added extra non-free streaming radiation, while the standard model component has remained the same. Another scenario, which hopefully I'll get a chance to talk about, is if you've replaced some of the standard model neutrinos by non-free streaming particles. I'll explain what replaced means hopefully towards the end of the talk. But for now, just note that if you take some of the neutrinos, you don't change n total. And if you replace them with similarly relativistic species that are still interacting, you just reduce the free streaming fraction below 1. So this is all to say that in various kinds of particle physics models, you can realize a wide range of parameter space in this plane of n toad and the free streaming fraction. So Gustavo and I did a Monte Carlo study of this simple scenario in the context of the latest Planck data to combine with Baryon acoustic oscillation data as well as the Ries et al. Measurement of Hubble constant, and the results are shown here. So this is showing a posterior distribution in the plane of a total radiation quantity and tot, as well as the free string fraction shown here. So the point here is that Planck and baryon acoustic oscillations are perfectly compatible with standard model values of 3 and 1. There is no preference, even at the one sigma level, for any non-standard contributions until you add the local value of H naught into the mix, in which case you start to prefer larger values of the total radiation density, and you start to see a preference for non-free streaming degrees of freedom emerge. But the preference is weak. It's at most a couple of sigma. So because of the non-free streaming nature of this extra radiation bath, and because of the effects that I've described that are somewhat degenerate with RS and RD, you can actually obtain larger contributions to radiation density in these kinds of models. This is shown here in this posterior distribution in the plane, the expansion rate, and in total. So these, the colored blobs, are two different models with non-free streaming degrees of freedom. So you can see that they overlap nicely with H naught, but note that I've combined all of the data sets here. And they do slightly better than ineffective alone, so they extend to higher values of H naught compared to ineffective, which is precisely a signature.
So if you just add the species of ineffective, let's say half a species, like let's say if ineffective was 3.6, then the measurement will be within a sigma. Sigma?
I'm cheating a little bit here because I'm combining all data sets here, some of which I maybe shouldn't be combining. So I think a more fair plot to show would be this one that I've shown towards the beginning of a talk, where I haven't included the data set, H-naught data set. So you can see that they're really discrepant at 2 sigma, so one shouldn't combine an effect or Planck data with H naught from Ries et al.
Okay.
If you were to plot the same plot with the non-free streaming species, they get really close. So one can start to think about doing a combination, but it's still kind of iffy, let's say. I think I should use the other plot for this purpose, but the statement that non-free streaming species that allows you to go to higher values of H naught is still true. So obviously, again, you can't go to arbitrarily large values of H naught here, and you're prevented from doing this by exactly the same physics that I've described. So if you're adding extra radiation density, which affects the diffusion scale, which in turn affects the high L modes of the CMV. So you're prevented from changing the CMV too much. And this limits how much extra stuff you can add. And this is actually true of many models that seek to solve a Hubble tension. So here's an application of these bands that Gustavo and I obtained to this non-abelian hidden sector that I've described. Because of the non-abelian nature of these hidden sectors, if they did have a coupling to a standard model, this coupling necessarily would have occurred through some kind of a higher dimensional operator, which means that these particles would have been, if they were ever in equilibrium, they would have been in equilibrium at early times, but then decoupled at late times. So there's some temperature TF below which they fell out of equilibrium. So in this context, you can actually predict what the contribution of a non-abelian hidden sector is as a function of this decoupling temperature TF and the number of degrees of freedom in the non-abelian gauge group. So for an SUN, for example, it's n squared minus one gluons. So in this plot, I'm showing two different predictions for what n fluid is in two different models, SU2 and SU3, shown by these two lines here, in combination with the bounds that Gustavo and I obtained as a function of a decoupling temperature.
Sorry, this is the decoupling temperature from the standard model, or just from itself?
From a standard model.
From itself, it never decouples.
From itself, it never decouples from a point of view of CMV. So it's below, much below an EV. So from this, you can see that these bounds are actually really powerful because they're potentially probing physics that could have occurred at temperatures of order GeV or higher. And even in some cases, depending on whether you take more strict or less strict bounds, you can rule out entire amount of hidden sectors that were ever in thermal equilibrium under some assumptions about the early universe side of things. So I'm running out of time. My next topic was going to be neutrino self-interactions, which is related to the models that I've talked about just previously. So, but in this case, instead of assuming that the interactions are relevant for the entirety of the CMB, in many realistic models, the interactions can be relevant for some time, but then decouple in some other time. So this is the case, for example, for standard weak interactions of neutrinos. So this is shown here in the plot on the right. As a function of the temperature, I'm showing the relative rate of weak interactions compared to Hubble. So at early times, this rate is larger than one, but then it falls below one at temperatures of order in MeV. So one can consider scaling this kind of interaction up where it's relevant at early times, but then decouples throughout some era during the CMB. In this case, because of this decoupling, our Gustavo's and mine analysis cannot be applied. So one has to do a separate thing. And this is something that's been done by various groups over the last 7 years or so. The most recent result is by Kreisch, Saracina, and Doré. And I found something really interesting. They found a consistent fit of CMB and baryon acoustic data to the high value of Ries H-naught measurement in terms of, so they parametrized their self-interactions of the neutrinos in terms of an effective G-Fermi interaction, which is from the CMB and Planck, from the CMB and H-naught data, comes out to be really enormous. So just qualitatively, the best fit points that they find for combined data sets give you values of G effective that are like 10 to the 9 times G Fermi. So this is huge. An interesting question is whether something like this can be realized in realistic particle physics models. And the answer is, it seems to be, it's really, really hard. In order to answer this question, together with some Fermilab colleagues, we've looked at a very simple UV completion of this scenario. So you just add an extra scalar that couples to standard model neutrinos. In this case, the self-interaction is mediated by this new scalar. These are the parameters that are preferred if you want to realize these kinds of strong self-interactions. So you can see the coupling is quite large. The masses are very low. So this means that there's an abundance of constraints coming both from laboratory as well as from cosmology that puts severe limits on how good this scenario can be. So because I'm running out of time, let me just show you the final results for one particular coupling. So you can assume different kinds of flavor structures for these couplings.
Sorry, this is SU2 invariant now. Let's talk about, can you present something that's SU2 invariant, please?
So I have not done this analysis, but this is by Liantao Wang's group. So they've written down a few SU2 invariant interactions. So this is not quite what you want. The point is that once you consider an SU2 invariant model, in addition to the bounds that I've shown in the previous slides, very briefly, coming from meson decays, BBN, and neutrinos double beta decay searches, if you consider an SU2 invariant case, you generate other operators that give you additional constraints. So the situation is even worse in the SU2 invariant case. So I think the statement there is that it's basically impossible to have self-interactions that are strong enough. I don't want to say impossible, but it's really, really hard, at least in the...
Is there a working model even at that?
Okay, so this is the last couple of slides.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is to not endow standard model neutrinos, standard left-handed neutrinos, with self-interactions, but replace them with some kind of a sterile self-interacting species. So sterile here means they are not charged under SU2 cross U1. Here's how one would go about doing this. So first, this replacement must happen after BBN to avoid constraints there. From a model building point of view, the way to accomplish this is to allow standalone neutrinos to couple to some light mediator. So this mediator is not responsible for generating the self-interactions, but it brings a dark sector that is self-interacting into equilibrium. The reason why this works is because if you estimate the rate for such interactions, this is an example with a decays and inverse decays, but you can do the same thing with scattering, for example. The scaling with temperature of such an interaction through a light mediator is such that it becomes more important at late times. So if you were ever out of equilibrium, so this plot showing the scaling of a reaction rate, so for example, this rate, compared to Hubble as a function of time, time flowing to the left, or sorry, to the right. If you're out of equilibrium, if your dark sector, strongly interacting dark sector is out of equilibrium initially, because of this temperature scaling, you'll tend to enter equilibrium. And then you might hit some mass threshold and you go out of equilibrium again. But the point is that this kind of rate, IR dominated interaction rate, will tend to bring a dark sector into equilibrium. And then you have much more freedom to do what you want inside of a dark sector in terms of self-interactions. So this kind of model has been these kinds of models have been just actually proposed just recently this year, a couple months ago, by these two groups. So I'm showing a couple of plots from this He, Ma, and Zhang paper, which make use of precisely the kinds of interactions that I've described in the previous slide. So the idea is that you have some extra mediator, sigma, that's connected to a dark sector. And this interaction brings these dark sector particles into thermal equilibrium with standalone neutrinos, effectively replacing some of them by self-interacting species. And the self-interaction within this dark sector is accomplished by some new gauge interaction. So from a cosmological point of view, the way this looks is the following. So this plot is showing the evolution of the number densities in the standalone neutrinos in blue, sorry, in red, and the self-interacting species in blue. So at early times, shown here on the right, all of your density is composed of standalone neutrinos. Then at some point, this rate becomes important and you rapidly convert some fraction of your standalone neutrinos into these other dark sector states, which is self-interacting. So you've replaced some of the standalone neutrinos by self-interacting states. And the parameter space for self-interactions, it's not completely open, but these authors find that there's some light space, but it's consistent with the CMB observations.
What is the dashed line here?
Yeah, so the dashed line corresponds to a self-interaction. So this GX is the hidden sector gauge coupling, which sets the size, the strength of a self-interaction, and max is the mass of the mediators. Along this line, these self-interactions decouple at a redshift of 8,000, which is kind of the number that corresponds to these kinds of self-interactions in standalone neutrinos. So they haven't done a full CMB study, so it's not obvious that their model does exactly the same or as successful as the one considered by Kreisch et al. But the point is that somewhere along this line, the physics is similar in the sense that you start in thermal and you start with self-interacting non-free streaming species, and they decouple at around the same time as was found in the Kreisch et al. Work. Does that make sense?
Nikita?
Yeah.
Is there a way to write down the coupling of this light mediator to the neutrinos in a way which is SE2 invariant so that you don't end up also having like electrons giving rise to this light mediator coming out?
Yes, there is. So this, I didn't want to write this thing down, but these have a fully UV complete model of this, which includes extra electroweak doublets. But essentially you start with some right-handed, so this model makes use of Dirac neutrinos that are charging you some extra U1. And in this case, you can write down interactions that don't introduce new couplings to electrons, at least at tree level.
Okay. It's a Dirac seesaw where the neutrino is a Dirac particle and everything that is dark only talks to the right hand.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So just a final comment about this. So you can see that you don't replace all of the neutrinos, all the standalone neutrinos by self-interacting species. You only replace some fraction. So it's not immediately obvious whether this kind of scenario will do as good of a job at explaining the Hubble tension. So there are still some outstanding questions.
To, can I ask a quick question? You have two questions about this. I mean, one, I mean, regarding your last comment that they didn't replace all of the standard model neutrinos, couldn't I just add a lot more stuff charged under this U1 and then I would effectively do it? I mean, here they seem to only want to replace, like, you know, each neutrino gets some friend, some Dirac friend, but you could just add more stuff.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's right. I think these people wanted to have like a simple possible UV completion, which still involves a lot of states. So I think they might have just wanted to keep it as simple as possible. But presumably you can do it.
And the other question is, I mean, as a UV complete model, couldn't they use the thing that you and Asher did with like neutrino mixing to get the coupling through a scalar and then give the scalar extra interaction?
Yeah, so this is, I think this is similar to like this piece is exactly what we did. So it's essentially this like late equilibration thing that Asher and I studied. I don't know why we didn't go with like just a scalar sector. Part of the reason, so one advantage this model has is that it also has a model, it's a model for neutrino masses. So they both get self-interactions in early universe as well as neutrino masses all within kind of the context of the same dark sector. You can probably do it with an extra, just a scalar sector, but then you probably wouldn't account for neutrino masses, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting how much fat you can cut off this model to like have a minimal working example.
So how would you know in all of these theories that this is how you explain? Is there a smoking gun signature of these things?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question and brings me to my conclusion, I think. And instead of reading the first two bullet points, I'm just going to emphasize this last point. All of these models, even those ones that are consistent with the data right now, they predict some deviation in the high L tail of a CMB. Mm-hmm. And this, nobody has compared whether these deviations are really smoking guns or whether they're degenerate in model space. But future CMB observatories like CMB S3 and S4 are targeting precisely this high L regions, so one can potentially distinguish them using their impact on the CMB. But I think that's all one can say for some of these scenarios. Like, models that try to add extra things into the mix, like dark matter or something like that, and they can be other signatures. I'm guessing, but from the CMB observable point of view, I think high L CMB power spectrum is the way to go.
But to wrap up, I mean, of all the models that you have studied, that it seems that the one that gives the best based fit is just self-interacting radiation.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not perfect. I think the interacting neutrinos, if one actually does this the CMB analysis for this kind of scenario where you have some partial fraction self-interacting, it would be interesting to see whether that does better as well. Yeah, so with that, let me conclude. So hopefully I've convinced you that the Hubble tension is significant and interesting, could possibly point towards new physics, but it's not all clear since different models that I've considered like face constraints either from cosmology or from particle physics experiments. But an optimistic take on this whole situation is that there will be more CMB data, there will be additional independent measurements of the expansion rate, which will either sharpen the tension or eliminate it completely. So there's an end in sight. All right, thank you. Sorry for going over time a bit.
No, it's okay.
No, it's fine.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But the usual, just like standard model self-interacting neutrinos, even though they don't really have a UV completion, that gives a better fit than the self-interacting radiation or not?
Yeah, well, so this, Gustavo will have some choice words for these authors. In the study that we've considered, we've basically fit to the entire available CMV dataset, whereas the results that these authors like make really central in their paper, they exclude, which is they're shown by this red blob here. Mm. They exclude polarization data, which you might find suspicious. So before the 2018 data release, there was a kind of a reason for doing this. Not really, because there's people claim there are some systematics in the polarization data that weren't properly accounted for. This has been fixed in the 2018 data release. But the point is that once you add polarization data, the significance of this high self-interaction regime goes way down.
Do you understand why? Is that easy to understand?
So I have a very hand-wavy explanation. So the statement is that the peaks in the CMV power spectrum appear much sharper in the polarization power spectrum than they do in the temperature power spectrum. So if you're shifting the peaks, which you're definitely doing here, or you're shifting your amplitudes, that is a kind of extra apparent in the polarization side of things. So if you include that data, you're constraining yourself more. In addition, polarization provides like just an additional set of data that you really should be including. So the constraints with the additional data are expected to be tighter. Hmm. I don't know, Gustavo, do you have any more insight into this?
Not really. I mean, it's something I wanted to look at again. I think that their paper, like also, if I remember correctly, but I sometimes mix these various papers, I think they had large ineffective in these interactions, and I think they also had large NS. So I don't know if maybe somehow polarization is allowing you to measure NS a little bit better because there's less effects of damping and stuff like that. So I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, so I guess another point is that they varied many, many parameters. In addition to this G-effective, they varied N-effective, the sum of neutrino masses. The cosmology that they get is very different from Lambda CDM. So it's possible that if we were to vary the same sort of parameters, or if we vary enough parameters in this non-free streaming fluid model, you might be able to improve the fit further.
Yeah, I guess the fit is still not good because your self-interacting radiation still travels farther away because it travels now not at this speed of light, but it travels at the speed of light divided by square root of 3, just as a sound wave. Mm-hmm. And the photons travel less because there are also baryons, which just push them back, I guess, right? But I guess you will engineer this the sound speed of the of your self-interacting radiation to scroll it to some dark baryons or something to make the shift just go away, completely go away.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. I'm not sure if anyone has... Well, I think Gustavo looked at some models where they've varied the sound speeds in some generic fluid at some point. Do you remember what the outcome was?
I mean, I haven't done it myself for lack of technical expertise, but I think like the Wayne Hu and Marco Raveri paper, like one of the Chicago group's papers, I think they looked at some like generalized scalar field things where they allowed the sound, like the effective sound speed and effective equation of state. I mean, they had some generalized fluid approach where they allowed some of the fluid parameters to vary. I think they found some. Yeah, I don't quite remember the conclusion, but it seemed like they want this parameter to evolve in time. I think they allowed it to evolve in time. I think that they were changing, like sort of transition between one behavior to another. And they just, I think, put it in by hand and they found it in a good fit doing that. But I don't remember super well how they did it and how physically motivated it was.
So I have a question you provided like many like of these solutions, but like mostly like you fit to like the CMB data, right?
Yeah.
So what about like if I want to add like the large cell structure like analysis, like will these things be changed in the similar ways?
So I think the constraints can potentially, so LSS would add extra constraints at low redshifts.
Yeah.
And none of the models that I talked about change early physics at low redshifts. So I think that additional data, as long as it's consistent with the data sets that we do use, then it would just lead potentially to somewhat stronger constraints, but I would be surprised if it changes the landscape significantly. So like one thing that we could add is supernova data that are uncalibrated. So these wouldn't constrain H naught directly, but they would constrain the shape of the expansion rate as a function of redshift. And presumably from the things from the analysis that I've seen, they don't like change too much unless you're really messing with the expansion rate at late times. So I would suppose that LSS would do something similar where it would lead to stronger constraints, but not like drastically change the allowed parameter space.
And do you mess up the power spectrum or something? Because the free streaming will wash out power at small scales, and that will affect CDM invariance. For instance, the neutrino free streaming affects the CDM invariance. If you put it or you don't put it, there's a difference.
So that's a good point. So the neutrinos affect the matter power spectrum because they at some point go non-relativistic.
So yeah, they do. But I thought there was also a drag effect that you can push down the variance or the CDM. I'm not sure, but
That very well might be because everything is interacting and via gravity. So there might be some higher order effect that I haven't mentioned. The things that I've talked about, like the phase shift, as well as the change of the gravitational potentials at early times, these are the dominant effects. So there might be something else that's more intricate that we don't know about.
I see. You haven't just calculated. But I guess class just gives you straight out of the box the power spectrum too, right? Because you modify class and you will give you the power spectrum. And you guys haven't noticed any dips at high K for the CDM.
That's a good question. I don't think we looked at the matter power spectrum. But that's something interesting to look into.
Yeah, maybe it's really small. I mean,
I think sort of the main thing that might give the large scale structure some extra power compared to the CMD, but I don't know if it's enough. I mean, I don't understand those measurements very well, is that most of those early solutions that you're sort of changing Hubble during the time of matter radiation equality tend to give you slightly more power actually at small scales. Like they make the sigma 8 problem worse, for example. So that might be something that somehow, once you're analyzing the data in terms of large scale structure, you will get some constraining power. And they just do it because, I mean, you're putting more energy. I don't fully understand all of those models, but usually it's just that you change some parameters that force it to raise omega matter a little bit or change NS a little bit. And that just, I mean, either one ends up giving you slightly more power at small scale. So it's just some observation that all of those models tend to give you larger sigma 8, which is this fluctuation that's sort of very close to the nonlinear scale.
Right. But for example, like if I think about like the vanilla effective, right? Like those neutrinos will be still around.
Yeah, but I mean, once you're much past matter radiation equality, they're a small effect, right? As long as they don't become matter, I mean, as long as they don't have mass. I mean, the neutrinos give an impact because a little bit after matter radiation equality, they get a mass, and they become a little bit of dark matter.
Right.
So
given that I know like large scale structure give you constraint on like neutrino masses, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds to me like it will also tell you something about an effect, like how they change over time.
No, I mean, I think what it does, yeah, if any of the extra radiation becomes matter, then I think matter power spectrum has something to say. But if it's just continuous radiation, it's just becoming more irrelevant at late times, right? It's not.
Yeah, it is affecting the CDM and baryon growth at early times, though. And I mean, it's before equality, which is a smaller effect then, but it's still an effect. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it became clear from, I mean, I think Nikita said it, but I mean, all of those models, I mean, the CMB really doesn't want to change the time of matter radiation equality. So I mean, the parameters always shift, like, so this is remain fixed.
No, that part I understand. I'm just talking about the perturbations, not of the overall thinking, right? I mean, because, well, look, so I'm not sure if this is correct, but if you're doing, so radiation is driving the potential at early times. Mm-hmm. So then the dark matter growth and the baryon growth will also get affected by that if you modify the potential that your radiation potential. So the growth of the CDM and baryon perturbations, just the gravitational growth of it, may also be affected by that effect.
That sounds reasonable.
It's true that most of the growth happens after equality, but a lot of the growth also happens before equality. So it's just a log, but still, right?
Yeah, and I mean, at those small scales are also probably affected by non-linearities as well. So that might, any effect that you might have might be reprocessed later on. So you're right. I think it'd be interesting to look at the actual power spectrum of sim model for these non-linearities. Because yeah, I don't think we did that.
Yeah, maybe it's really just not, I don't know.
I mean, because from Leonardo's talk that he gave some weeks ago, it seemed like, I mean, they're still always looking at the linear power. I mean, at modes that are still within the linear treatment, right? They're not really doing
always seeing linear.
Yeah. Okay. They're parametrizing, I guess, effects from nonlinear modes to higher dimensional operators or whatever, but not really looking using that part of the data.
Sure, but whatever scale you imprint, it's going to affect that and all the smaller modes. Mm-hmm. So then you will, like, the power spectrum will be affected on that scale and all the smaller ones. So you have to look at structure data just in smaller modes too. Lyman alpha, whatever, galaxy counts, I don't know. But maybe it's just a tiny effect, I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah,
I think it was a good question. Thanks.
Have more questions?
So I wanted to ask about the first scenario you talked about. Mm-hmm. What kind of mixings do you need for that to work, or to almost work?
So I think I've estimated this briefly, and it's around 10 to minus 3. So this is for these masses, these mixings are compatible with all models.
Yeah, this is kind of curious because there's this big growing literature in neutrino physics where people try to make EV steros compatible with early cosmology. So
yes,
they use the same models to do that. So
yeah,
I wonder what the connection here is.
Well, the connection is that they care about mixing angles that are much larger than this. So it's kind of confusing. Sometimes we talk about sine squared theta. And the angles that are incompatible with cosmology are sine squared theta of like 0.1 or something like that, or 0.2. Here, it's not the square of angle, it's 0.1. It's the square of angle is actually many orders of magnitude smaller.
Yeah, I wonder though, there's a recent work by, I think, Joaquin Kopp, where he does, instead of oscillations with EV sterols, it's actually decays.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, I think it considers 100 EV sterol. I don't know if that's too heavy for you. It's produced through mixing and it decays into the scalar, which then in turn may also decay into new bar pairs. And I think for that, the mixings that you needed are much, much smaller. I don't know if it's 10 to the minus 5, which seems to be what you need here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be interesting. And the other thing I wanted to say is, these last models with neutrino self-interactions by giving interactions to the sterol component.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ones that appear in the literature so far, they look very complicated because people put in new interactions by introducing a new doublet, which mm-hmm. allows it to write down the neutrino portal with a dark doublet. But there's a much easier way of doing this where you can just add a completely sterol family so not charged under the new U1 prime symmetry. And you can add another charged family. And then, you know, with a new singlet scalar in that case, standard model singlet, you can generate neutrino mixing and basically reproduce the scenarios with much less complications. Because one of the things I don't know if these papers have looked at in detail, I haven't read them in detail, so I don't know, is constraints from B and K decays, because they have this new doublet, which in principle gives mass mixing and so on. So
yeah, so
I don't know if you looked into that.
So I haven't looked at the constraints. The doublets that are introduced in this paper, which I'm the most familiar with, they're at a mass of like 10 to the 9 GeV. I'm not super familiar with the B and K bounds in this context. It seems like a really high scale, but I guess flavor obviously also has the ability to constrain very high scales as well. So I'm not sure how they, what the relationship there is.
I see. Yeah, I just say this because of the mass of the mediator seems to be very small.
Okay, guys, right, I'm going to stop recording now, but if there are more questions, just please keep making them. It's fine for that, but just like to let people go, whoever wants to go, and also to just stop recording, but everyone else is welcome to stay. Let's thank Nikita again for this great talk. Thanks.